Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today, we are spending the hour discussing the fall of the U.S.-backed Afghan government and the Taliban taking control of Afghanistan. The United Nations estimates that more than 100,000 Afghan civilians have been killed by the Taliban and other insurgents, as well as international coalition forces. U.S. drone strikes have also killed thousands of innocent Afghans, and nearly 2,500 U.S. soldiers have died. Joining us to discuss media coverage are three guests. Rafia Zakara is a columnist for Dawn, Pakistan's largest English newspaper. She also writes for the Baffler magazine. She's the author of three books, including her latest, Against White Feminism, Notes on Disruption. Her latest piece for The Nation magazine is called White Feminists Wanted to Invade, and she writes, Afghan women never asked for U.S. airstrikes. Rafia Zakaria was born and raised in Karachi and now lives in Pakistan and the United States. Hi, Rafia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
It's great to have you. Tamim Ansari is an Afghan-American author based in San Francisco. He was born in Kabul and lived in Afghanistan until he was 16. He has published essays in many, many publications. He's the author of many books, including Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan, and his latest, The Invention of Yesterday, A 50,000-Year History of Human Culture, Conflict, and Connection. In a Guardian piece he wrote last month, Tamim Ansari says, the great irony of the Western project to bring democracy and social project to Afghanistan is this. Afghans have a powerful, progressive current of their own. Hi, Tamim. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, hi, it's my pleasure.
Great to have you. And Emran Faraz is an Austrian with Afghan roots who writes for many publications. He's the founder of Drone Memorial, a virtual memorial for civilian drone strikes. In his latest piece for Deutsche Welle, he writes that things were going wrong in Afghanistan had been obvious for a long time, yet the West preferred to look the other way. Hi, Emran. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have all of you. There's so much to discuss. First off, let's just talk about what happened over the last couple of weeks. So many people in the U.S. media have basically expressed shock that this happened so fast. Emran, in your latest piece, said much of what was going on in Afghanistan was suppressed and ignored for years, not only because people in the West wanted to save face, but also because they still didn't know Afghanistan, even after all these years. So can you just talk about your reaction to what happened so quickly and then the reaction in the media?
Sure, I will try it. I mean, what I meant in this piece is regarding the recent developments before the fall of Kabul to the Taliban. We saw how many other provincial capitals fell. And also during this process, many people, many Western observers were quite surprised how this could happen. And I tried to describe the different reasons for it. So first of all, what many people ignored that in many of these provincial capitals, around them in the districts, the Taliban had a stronghold for years. I mean, I visited a couple of them during the last years, and also until recently, a few months ago, when I had my last research reporting trip to Afghanistan. And it was every time the same. If you went to Jalalabad, to Kunduz, to Mazar-e-Sharif, to Herat, in all these places, you had the provincial capital and you just needed a short drive to reach Taliban territory. So this was a reality that was ignored for many years. And now we saw how, the whole domino effect. On the other side, what many people in the West now say, ignorant things like, why are the Afghans not fighting? What's up with the Afghan army? What's wrong with them? Mm. They couldn't defend themselves, so they don't care about their country. This is totally wrong. I mean, what we saw from the very first day of the occupation of Afghanistan by the Western military forces was that the foreign soldiers allied themselves with many corrupt politicians, drug barons, warlords, very questionable people. And together with them, the international forces tried to create a good government. And the problem from the very beginning was that these individuals, in my opinion, were not interested in anything like that. They just enriched themselves and fueled massive corruption. And this continued for years and years and years. And of course, the security sector was also affected by that. So that what we could witness during the last years was that, and also until the last months, I mean, for example, you know, you saw that soldiers on the ground didn't get much while corrupt officials in Kabul enriched themselves. How does this look like at the end? February, March, I went to Kunal province and visited soldiers on the ground next to the Pakistani border. And a lot of them didn't have anything, you know, they didn't have proper food. They didn't have much ammunition. They didn't have, you know, proper shoes and all that. So a lot of stuff was missing. And last but not least, they also didn't get their salaries regularly. And of course, these developments, if you have this for years and years and years, and you're always fighting for corrupt elites, literally serving as cannon fodder, I mean, Afghan soldiers often, you know, the casualties amongst them was 3 to 4 times higher, at least, than civilian casualties in Afghanistan during the last years. Of course, at the end, you see them, you know, stopping with their loyalty and just saving their lives.
Right. Tamim Ansari, what would you add? You wrote this piece for The Guardian last month. History shows us that outsiders can never bring peace to Afghanistan. First off, what was your reaction when you saw this happen so quickly? And on that piece of it, what are your thoughts about the media coverage? And there, a lot of people are just so shocked that this happened so fast.
Well, you know, I was surprised that it happened so fast, but ultimately I was not surprised because although unlike Imran, I've only been there twice since 9/11. Once was right after the Taliban were ousted and another time 10 years later. And, you know, what I was struck by in 2002 when I went there was that despite so much physical destruction of the city, I landed there and I felt like I could recognize the culture. I could recognize a sense of the Afghanistan that I remembered from my childhood growing up there. And when I went back 10 years later, it was remarkable the extent to which that sense of an Afghan culture was eerily missing. And I think, you know, in the and I've talked with my friends who come and go, and I feel like, you know, from an analytical point of view, this this American project had three things going for it in terms of trying to make a success in Afghanistan. And one was America had this vast military power. Another was that America and the West in general had a ton of money to bring to Afghanistan. And the third was an assumption that the cultural features that Americans were bringing to Afghanistan, you know, which I can summarize as elections, democracy, constitution, all of these things. Here in America, I am very concerned about the destruction of elections and all of that kind of undermining of the Western systems. But in Afghanistan, that hadn't been the system. You know, that was an unrecognizable thing there. And when this trillions of dollars dropped on a country which had been so physically and socially destroyed, I feel like there was no infrastructure for absorbing all that money. So what do you think happens when you drop $1 trillion in a public square with no, you know, with no controls over it? Rats will come storming in and grab what they can. And that's what happened in Afghanistan. I'm completely with Imran on saying that, you know, for years now, and I can't say that necessarily it's useful to blame the people who were involved in this corruption. They were standing next to the money. They grabbed what they could. And, none of them trusted that this American project was going to go on forever. So I think most people were saying it's going to end right now. I got to get my what I can and be ready for the future when the chaos comes.
Hmm.
These several times when I was in Afghanistan, one thing that I noticed was I met some people who were soldiers and I met some people who were in the police forces. And I felt like, you know, these are guys with a day job collecting a salary. And there is no cultural sense of we're defending our country against somebody else. It wasn't clear what the country was that anybody was defending. So that's the sense in which I wasn't surprised when all these cities fell so rapidly. I felt like, you know, all this time, there has in fact been a war going on in Afghanistan. And the war, I would say, began to be lost more dramatically when it turned into a drone war. I don't think, you know, drones are a way to win hearts and minds in the countryside that you're bombing. So I think that, you know, when the Taliban made that final push, I experienced it as Afghans generally saying, "Oh, we're so sick of war, whatever, come on in, take over." Mm-hmm. But, you know, then the question is, all right, they're in the cities now, but is it really over? I think it isn't really over.
And we'll talk about drone strikes and the brutality of these drones later in the show. As Emron points out in his piece, drone attacks and brutal nightly raids regularly caused a number of civilian casualties in Afghan villages, and many survivors shifted their support to the Taliban as a result. But before we talk about that, I'd love your thoughts on all of this, Rafia. What went through your mind when you saw these cities fall so quickly, and then what are your thoughts about, you know, people in the West expressing shock?
Well, you know, I was not at all shocked when I saw that the cities fell as quickly as they did. I think there is what I would call the great feminist delusion, at least among women in the United States and at large in the United States, that you know, the U.S. presence had somehow created some kind of a semi-paradise for Afghan women where everyone was working and going to school and having, you know, this great life, which the Taliban are going to take away. As as Tamim and Imran have pointed out, there were so many casualties. Thousands of Afghan families were bombed in villages, you know, there, which meant that Afghan women who the U.S. claimed to have invaded to liberate were actually caught in situations where they, you know, they didn't know how to support themselves. They were in refugee camps, or the entire structures of their lives were destroyed. And the idea here in the U.S. is that, oh, well, you know, so what if we bombed those villages? We built a girls' school there. So, you know, we're educating the women, so it's all forgiven. And of course, it doesn't work like that. I mean, not only did it not actually create inroads in the sense that, you know, if you look at USAID expenditures, they'll never count the number of women that were actually, or girls that were actually going to school. They just count the schools, which means that they just built these buildings, and God knows, you know, if there was ever a class that happened in these buildings. But it's put forward as like this great benevolent effort to educate Afghan women and lift them up, when really this is a brutal, long-standing war with many, many casualties that has destroyed structures, even familial structures in Afghanistan. So, you know, you have these situations where, you know, women were, the cultural transformations that needed to take place, that would have had to come from the grassroots, were never invested in. Instead, there was this trickle down feminism a la Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright and Laura Bush, where it was like, oh, well, we'll tell you how to be empowered. And with this sort of, this kind of insistent and very stubborn and wrong-headed belief that Afghan women themselves had no idea of what would be empowering to them. And so the consequences is what you see now. And it's really revolting because, you know, I see Clarissa Ward on CNN just regurgitating the same, you know, rubbish from 2001 mm-hmm. about, oh, the Taliban, oh, the burqa, oh, this, oh, that, which is just, it's revolting is the only word I can think of because it shows that nothing has been learned in these 20 years about what Afghans are, what they want, their cultural and religious and ethical and social frameworks. All it is, you know, Muslim women and burqa. Like, that's it, sum total. And then, of course, like some other sort of, you know, draconian Sharia law. That's like the other favorite phrase. And I mean, it shows if you want to see why this was such a disaster, you can just look at the inane and just absolutely, you know, self-congratulatory way in which this coverage is being carried out right now.
And it's such a good point because when you look at how this is framed, many in the U.S. media say, well, it was 9/11. Oh, it was democracy. I mean, so many different reasons here. And in your piece for The Nation, Rafia, you remind us that on a March evening in 1999, a wealthy Hollywood socialite named Mavis Leno, the wife of late night superstar Jay Leno, held a fundraiser to which she invited her rich and famous friends. The event was to benefit the Feminist Majority Foundation's campaign to, quote, end gender apartheid in Afghanistan. Then came 9/11 and the revelation that the organization behind the attack, Al-Qaeda, was holed up in Afghanistan. As you write, the George W. Bush administration, always looking for justification for war, found just the thing in the Feminist Majority's campaign. And by November, First Lady Laura Bush was arguing that the reason for the war was to, quote, liberate Afghan women. So can you tell us more about this and why it's so important to remember all of this?
The reason it's important to remember is because it shows how American feminism, which at one point used to be anti-war, pro-justice, not, you know, allied with the state in its efforts to bomb other countries, completely did, you know, and at least organizationally, did an about turn in that moment in 2001, where literally representatives from NOW and Feminist Majority were present when Colin Powell made the announcement about the invasion of Afghanistan. And the idea was, is that, you know, that was being sold is that, you know, this was going to protect white American women ultimately from terrorists at home. So all those brown terrorists sitting in Afghanistan could now be bombed. And the moral rationale behind it was that, you know, was that Afghan women were going to be saved. But there was also a huge amount of Western and I would say white hubris in that moment, which kept being replicated throughout the two decades, which meant that, you know, actual programs that were built allegedly to, say, train Afghan women for jobs or these, you know, which USAID carried out its biggest women's empowerment program, $400 million. In Afghanistan, and it ended up benefiting only three women, $400 million. That's all they can account for. And the reason was that, you know, the feminism as construed by Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright and Laura Bush and even Gloria Steinem supported the invasion at one point for this purpose of liberating women, is that you took this white middle class, lean in type feminist recipe and tried to force it down the throats of Afghan women. It was this, you know, idea that it was going to be this trickle down feminism. Well, I mean, obviously it didn't trickle down at all. because Afghan women had ideas and have ideas about what their own empowerment looks like, what they want to prioritize. And there was just no effort at all to incorporate that because of course the whole entire project of saying that we're going there to save the women or liberate the women or whatever was a big lie. It was just a gloss. The point wasn't whether these programs worked. The point was that the war could be covered up in this gloss of, you know, alleged women's empowerment. And then that would allow the war to go on and on and on as long as it did, because there was this idea of accrued benevolence, you know, where the U.S. was and the women who championed Afghan women were accruing this essentially like a inflated version of virtue signaling, where it's like, we're so great, we're going out there to do this for these women and, you know, and spending all this money. So these are the realities of this war. You know, I mean, yes, there is a small, thin sliver of Afghan women who benefited from the aid economy that the United States created by pouring in all this money and throwing more and more money. But as I think Tamim and Imran have both pointed out, as soon as that money's gone, which is now, the whole house of cards falls flat. Mm. Because, you know, because there was no effort to make it sustainable or to make it a bottoms-up project.
Imran, can you jump in here and talk about that? Because the funding, the money part of this is also reported in a simplistic way. It's that, you know, the United States spent, wasted, whatever word you want to use, $2 to $3 trillion without really drilling down to look at, for example, the program that Rafia brings up, this Promote, which cost $418 million and yeah, you know, barely did a thing. So can you talk about that and how the funding aspect of it should be covered?
Yes, I mean, first of all, I really want to appreciate that I'm in such a constructive round with Tamim and Rafia. I appreciate all the points both of them made until now. It's really refreshing. I'm saying this because in the last days, I had so many interviews, so many talks, both in English and in German, a lot of them in German, here in Germany and Austria. And it was really frustrating because obviously it's not just that a lot of people don't know what happened during the last years, but you always see the ignorance and all these things like, oh, now is Sharia law returning to Afghanistan, or what happened over there, what do the people think, did the Taliban change, and all these, you know. And then you have 4 minutes time to explain everything to someone who doesn't know much. So I really appreciate to be here now. And regarding your question, the money, the flow of the money, what Rafia already mentioned, I think, were the ghost schools, for example. So we had a lot of schools in Afghanistan, and we had corrupt officials who tried to get money for the schools, but the schools just existed on paper, or we had empty buildings described as girls' schools to get extra money. While grassroots movements, for example, last year, I wrote a very detailed piece for foreign policy together with a colleague of mine about the school in southeastern Khost province, which was run by a teacher, a local teacher, who the school was literally his own living room. He had one house, one room, and the school was his room. So during over the day, his children and his wife, they were not within the living room, or they helped him with teaching the children. It was also a girls' school, and it was really fascinating to see that, because he really tried to reconcile all the people over there. He had sisters and daughters of Taliban fighters who visited the school, and they didn't have a problem to have a male teacher. At the same time, he had to struggle with other Taliban fighters who threatened him, and also, of course, with many villagers, because they didn't like it too at first. And the ridiculous thing was that such projects never reached a single dollar, while we had all these individuals who made themselves rich with all the aid money. And it's really difficult. I don't know where to start, you know, regarding all the mess that happened with the money. Of course, I agree with Tamim that you had all these rats who were just next to the money, and they took it and grabbed it. But let's take a look where a lot of this money actually landed. And where we could find it. Actually, a lot of them is in the United Arab Emirates, because the Karzai government started to loot the aid money and reinvested it in, you know, luxury property and all these things abroad. I think recently someone reached me out who found even some stuff, you know, aid money that ended in Germany, which was used by the president of the parliament, of the Afghan parliament. And yeah, so a lot of this money, I mean, also when it comes to NGOs, I've heard some of the most ridiculous stories where you really think, how could this happen? Let me give you an example. You come to Afghanistan in the early 2000s, you think, hey, and I'm talking here mainly about diaspora Afghans who grew up in the US or in Europe. And unfortunately, I couldn't cover this in much detail back then because I was too young in the early 2000s. So when September 11 took place, I was 9 years old. And in afterwards, when the invasion started, you had these people and everyone started to make an NGO or started to work with the government, and they could easily get money. Aid money, they just, you know, applied for it, and you know, the foreign governments gave them hundreds of thousands. I heard from an African American woman who, in these years, you know, she applied for the money, she received it for her NGO to build a school. She invested, I don't know, maybe 10,000 of it, and you know, made some pictures, put it online, and showed it to everyone here. So this is our project. And she took the other 300,000 or 400,000, went back to the US and bought a house. Okay, so this is the stuff that happened. This is not something extraordinary. This happened regularly. I know so many corrupt people, Afghans from abroad, who went to Afghanistan, who literally thought, hey, I didn't get a proper job here in Europe on the US. Maybe I should try and do it in Afghanistan because I have ties. I know someone. Of course, they had powerful politicians as relatives, and then it was much more easier to get access to such money. And they just looted everything. And until recently, the last time I was in Afghanistan, a few months ago, I met such an individual, and I was with my cousin. So my cousin, a regular Afghan who studied, he's an engineer. He studied in Afghanistan, and he worked, and he received around $100 or $150 per month, okay, for his work, full-time job as an engineer. You know, he was in constructing. That was his salary. And then by accident, we met someone, an Afghan-American, who got a government job or who was close to these corrupt circles. And he literally made fun of him and said, you know, what is this? What are you doing here? Just make your job and, you know, get your money, but get it real. I can introduce you to some people, etc. And my cousin became so angry when he heard it. And afterwards, he told me, hey, you know, what's wrong? Who is this guy? And I didn't like it. All these people, they come here, they loot, and then they leave. And he's right. The people like my cousin, who really put a lot into their education, who know their country, who try to build something, to be honest, of course, you know, because many of them are also really, you know, they're Muslims. They take a lot of stuff seriously. They say, listen, for example, this money is halal, this is haram, I don't take it. And he was like, this American Afghan guy, he just literally told me, take your haram money and shut up, be happy with it. And this attitude happened for 2 decades. And it's mainly amongst the elitist circles that Rafia also described. And for that reason, you now have a lot of people who are angry, a lot of masses. Of course, not of them are pro-Taliban, but a lot of people, they are angry. They didn't like, they knew what was happening and nobody listened to them. And now, of course, everything is part of this mess.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Emran Faraz, a writer, founder of Drone Memorial. We're also joined by Rafia Zakaria, a columnist for Dawn, Pakistan's largest English newspaper. Tamim Ansari is a writer and author. His latest book, The Invention of Yesterday, a 50,000-year history of human culture, conflict, and connection. Today, we are talking about media coverage of the fall of the U.S.-backed Afghan government and the Taliban taking control of Afghanistan. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are spending the hour discussing media coverage of the fall of the U.S.-backed Afghan government. We're joined by Rafia Zakaria, a columnist for Dawn, Pakistan's largest newspaper. She's the author of three books. Her latest is Against White Feminism, Notes on Disruption. Emran Faraz is a writer, journalist, founder of Drone Memorial, a virtual memorial for civilian drone strike victims. Tamim Ansari is a writer and author. His latest is The Invention of Yesterday. You can find all of their pieces, really important pieces, at yourcallradio.org. Tamim, I want to go back to something Rafia and Emran both said. The language that the media are using sounds so similar to what they used in 2000. And just getting ready for today's show, I had CNN on in the back. And a U.S. politician, he didn't look familiar to me. I did not catch his name. But he said that the Afghan soldiers did not succeed because they are tribal and incompetent. I mean, this is the language that we are still hearing. And in your piece for The Guardian, you have important history. I mean, you go back to 1839, but you don't have to go back that far. But a lot of people in this country, I mean, after 20 years of an invasion, just don't know basic information. And I think something you write, I think, is so important as we're hearing these tribal, you know, they're a different culture. You write that the great irony of this Western project to bring democracy and social progress to Afghanistan is this. Afghans have a powerful progressive current of their own. It's Islamic, not secular, but it's progressive. In the six decades after the country gained independence from the British and before it was invaded by the Soviets, Afghanistan was governed by Afghans. During that time, what did the Afghan government achieve? It liberated Afghan women from the burqa, promulgated a constitution, created a parliament with real legislative power, built schools, set up elections, pushed for co-education. I mean, the list is long. Can you just talk about the importance of this and the fact that we're hearing these tribal words still today in the media?
You know, the list is long, and let me just say this about that word tribal. You know, there is Afghan culture is a culture that's largely about interpersonal connections. And I think the word tribal sort of falsifies that. Tribal just automatically seems to mean primitive and all of those kinds of things. And, you know, in the six decades that I was talking about, you know, it started when there was a Talibanist-like revolution, and the so-called son of the water carrier took over Kabul, and for about 9 months, Afghanistan was plunged into this revolution and this war, and it was a Taliban-like moment in Afghan history. And then those forces were overthrown, and an Afghan dynasty came back into power, and the first thing that it did was it secured itself in the country by being more Muslim than thou. You know, Nader Shah was the king who took over, and he clamped down, he shut down the country. But and if you were on the streets without a chaudhari, as they called it, you know, as we in Afghanistan called the word that is called burqa, seen everywhere else. If you were a woman, you had to wear a chaudhari outside. If you were a man and you were out there eating in the month of Ramadan, you were going to be arrested. All of those kinds of things. But there was one thing that Nader absolutely respected. The government did not have any right to go into the private world of any clan, any family, any tribe. So there was this inner world that Afghans lived in, and then there was the public world that the government controlled. So there was some sense of that all along coming up into the present moment and into that progressive moment in the 60s. You know, when they made their move on the Chaudhary, the dynasty that was in control of Afghanistan at that point, they didn't pass a law that said nobody can wear a Chaudhary or anything like that. What they did was they called the religious scholars to the court, and they said, we're puzzled. We don't see this thing about the Chaudhary in the Quran, and we want to be good Muslims, so show us where it says that. And of course, in the Quran, it doesn't say that. So then the royal family said, well, you know, if it doesn't say it in the Quran, then we're not going to do that. We want to be in line with the Quran. And after that, the royal family took the lead, and when it was public events, the women of the royal family appeared without chaudhari, with their faces showing. So that was the way, the little finger here, the little outreach there that the social progress was pursued in Afghanistan. And in the course of 20 years that I was, living there, the social progress was probably 3,000 years of social progress in 20 years. Of course, that was jolting, but that was much more gradual and culture related than the changes that came afterwards. Because in 2002, what happened was that a whole framework of institutions was sort of dropped on the culture, and then people were left to try to fit into that. Now, just before I depart from that, I just want to say this, because I do want to make this point, having listened to Rafia and Imran, with whom I really agree with you guys. I'm really glad to be on this show with you. I do want to say that there was lots of private people who were in Afghanistan trying to do things which by their own lights were good, and they were not bad people, and they did try to do good things. And some of these people did do some school ventures that were good. And there was this guy that started a circus, that went all over Afghanistan and drew in children. That was a good thing. There were good things going on. Mm. And, over when I went there in 2002, I went with Asma Ishan, who had this project that she started right after 9/11 called Bare Roots Project. And it didn't involve government money or anything. And in fact, it didn't involve lots of money at all. What she did was she collected some money from people around here in the Bay Area, and then a bunch of us would go to Afghanistan, and we didn't get money from the government or anything. Everybody that went had to pay their own way. And what we did was we bought bare root saplings in Kabul from a nursery in Kabul, and then we took it out to places in, around Kabul and in the villages and then further out. And she said to people, do you need trees? Do you want to plant trees? Of course, mm-hmm. the denuding of trees was one of the catastrophes that was left over from the Soviet wars and all of those things. And people would say, yes, we want trees. So then we would all work together to plant those trees. And the next year, Asma would come back with more bare root saplings. And if the trees were growing, she would give those trees to them. It was individual people meeting individual people and making personal connections. And I want to contrast that to when I was in Kabul, for instance. There was every place we drove, there were barricades. And behind those barricades, apparently, there was something called the Green Zone. I was never in the Green Zone, and in there were coffee houses and this and that, very much of a kind of a European feel to it. But I was in the other part of Kabul where everybody was wearing the kind of clothes that are traditional amongst Afghans, pirana tumban, the loose trousers, the long shirt. And it was just like a completely different Afghanistan right outside the Green Zone. So I think there's this whole cultural thing that the problem was for officialdom in Afghanistan on the American side, on the Western European side, that they didn't have person-to-person contact with real, ordinary Afghans living in Afghanistan. And a lot of the trouble can be sourced back to that.
You make so many good points, and also I think it's important. I want to make sure we touch on this before we end, Rafia, because so many in the media keep talking about Afghan women, and they're going to be covered up. And I mean, in many cases, I mean, it is horrific what is going to be, what is already happening to women. A lot of women who are journalists say that they are not able to go to work. Some women who worked in the bank say they're not able to go to work. But can you spend some time talking about what women in Afghanistan have done for themselves and their people over the last 20 years, because this is not really getting much attention. I will say on NPR, Mahbuba Siraj, founder of the Afghan Women's Network, said, "I have been working in this country for 20 years. We look after the women. We looked after the children. We dig wells. We teach people how to look after their health. We try to have schools. There's nothing I'm ashamed of. So for that matter, I'm not going to hide anything from anyone." And then back in April, we had on Fatima Hosseini, a photojournalist and artist in Kabul, Tamana Ayazi, a journalist and filmmaker in Kabul. Can you just talk about the gains that so many women in Afghanistan have made on their own? Because I think this deserves more attention.
Yes, I mean, it's undoubted that Afghan women did make gains. They were out. There were women politicians who were campaigning in far-flung rural areas. There were, you know, activists who were working with women at the grassroots level. There were women who were trying to, you know, like you said, come up with a health worker program where, you know, female health workers could go into, you know, go into the homes of various rural families and provide them with basic health care, basic education and hygiene, and how to take care of their babies. So it's undoubted that the progress was taking place. It was that progress, I mean, it's almost as if the U.S. presence was offered up as or the U.S. threat to leave was offered up as a stick to Afghans, where they had to agree to the U.S. staying there in exchange for this sort of some meager level of security or, you know, money to be put into their political institutions. And I think that that part is connected to the fact that while all of this was happening, Islamophobia within the U.S. was skyrocketing, right? So the you are not going to value what Afghan women are doing if you think that all Muslims are terrorists. And that is the equation that was pushed on Afghan women as well. Was that, you know, for instance, like Sharia law. I mean, the Sharia, there was a huge GOP-led effort to ban Sharia all over the United States, which was just ludicrous because, I mean, there is no Sharia in the United States, has its own legal system. But those sorts of ideas were then used as a frame to look at the achievements or lack thereof of Afghan women. Right. And the fact is that, you know, if you use the Western white frame of what contributions matter, you're going to look for what? You're going to look for rebellion, for risk taking, for, you know, initiating new things. Those aren't bad qualities. But the fact is that there's an omission here of resilience, of endurance, of, you know, building solidarity instead of just your own personal wealth. So when you don't have those qualities recognized as essential feminist qualities, as essential qualities that allow women to do things for their societies, you just erase and silence all of those women who have shown their resilience, who have endured so much, you know, beyond what anyone can imagine. But that's the thing, is that there is this frame that just insists on the valuation of what the U.S. or what white Western people imagine as good and as valuable. Mm-hmm. And that erasure is what causes this kind of insanity in the coverage, where like there's this idea, you know, like you pointed out, using these really, really Islamophobic words to denounce people who don't look like you and, you know, don't value the same things as you. I think the meme's point of interpersonal relations is absolutely essential there. And the lubricant of those interpersonal relations in Afghanistan are women. They're the ones who maintain them. And because of that, they have, you know, a huge role to play in society that is not only just, you know, going out and being a journalist or, I mean, not that those things aren't important, but the fact is that every Afghan woman living today has sacrificed so much and has shown such resilience and such courage. Okay. And, but because we look at it through this white Western, framework, that, you know, again, we're looking for the women that, you know, the arc of the story that's always told is, oh, you know, my life was so, I was living in such oppression in Afghanistan. And then like somehow I ran off. This is a literal story from the New York Times. Somehow I ran off. And I got near an American base and now I got asylum and now I'm here and now in the U.S. I'm free. Mm. If that's the equation you're going to present, that no Afghan woman can be free if she continues to stay in her own culture and that her culture is somehow inherently unfeminist, you're never going to have any true, authentic respect for Afghan women. Mm.
This is such a good point, and I wish we had another hour because I've also been so struck by, I guess, the ease with which the media are talking about, you know, what it will take to bring the translators to the United States or other European countries, what it will take to bring people who aligned with the U.S. government. What about the people who opposed the U.S. invasion? Not to say that people should have to leave their country. But the framing around that, Imran, has really struck me, where there's U.S. journalists, U.S. veterans talking about the need to get the people that helped them out of the country. But if you didn't help the Americans, well, you're out of luck. We don't have much time, but do you have any thoughts on that? Just a minute, because I also want to ask you about drones.
Yes, I'll try to make this short. I mean, that's absolutely right. There were people who opposed the invasion and the occupation, or they talked, you know, within the Afghan diaspora also, but also within Afghanistan. A lot of people who did this, who had some activism, a lot of activism, but not because they were pro-Taliban, but because they were against an illegal invasion, against these war crimes that took place and radicalized so many people, like in the case of drone strikes. And often these people were labeled as, you know, terrorist supporters, Taliban apologists. I know some people in the U.S. Who really also had a lot of problems because they had a clear stance against the Bush administration. And I'm not really aware of all the details of, you know, in the U.S., how the state can punish you indirectly by, you know, getting more taxes from you and all that stuff. I don't know all these details because I'm not from the U.S., but I've heard that a lot of them made such experiences. And I think that, while a lot of people in Afghanistan were often labeled by many of those Afghans who benefited from the occupation and the whole system that was built on it.
And Imran, we need to do a whole show on drones because this deserves far more attention. But again, in your piece, you write that, you know, these drone attacks and these nightly raids cause so many civilian casualties in Afghan villages. I mean, I was just reading about, you know, some of the soldiers that were actually charged with killing Afghans and killing them in very brutal ways. And as you say, many survivors shifted their support to the Taliban as a result. In our final minute, you know, given that you that you run the drone memorial. What do we need to know and just be reminded of about U.S. drone strikes and what it did and what they did in Afghanistan?
Yes, I mean, I'm covering drone strikes for years extensively. I've written a whole book about it. I have visited a couple of areas within Afghanistan, rural villages that have been affected by drone strikes. And I think it's one of the most brutal things of warfare that we have witnessed during the 21st century. And I think it's also something that undermined the, you know, justice and the idea of justice within Western societies, because often we hear people here talking and praising how it is great to be, you know, to not have executions, you know, not having the death penalty. Of course, it's a bit different in the US, but in Europe, people are very proud of it. And Europe is part of the drone complex of the United States. And also many US states, you know, it's the death penalty is seen as something very savage and something that mustn't happen anymore. At the same time, it has become totally okay during the last 20 years to extrajudicially kill people without any proof, just because of some things they did or something, or the place they live in or how they look like or the people they're connected to, or, you know, drone strikes and, you know, how people has been classified to be attacked by it. I mean, military aged males, we have all these definitions to make it possible, also legally and politically, and, you know, the whole language that has been built around it to justify it was one of the most brutal things ever. And I think if you see it also on the ground, I'm not saying that all people that have been affected by the strikes, you know, became Taliban fighters. But the thing is that these areas have been affected so long by it that, for example, after the Americans and the Taliban signed off their withdrawal deal in 2020, a lot of people in the Afghan cities were like, okay, what is this? The Taliban are undermining everything. This is not about peace, etc. Of course, you can criticize it, but I think it was significant how people in rural areas reacted. Mm-hmm. They were like, okay, so finally we don't have any airstrikes, any drone strikes anymore.
Well, Imran, we will definitely do an entire show about drones because it is so important. We are out of time, and I just want to tell all of you that we got a number of phone calls from people who said they didn't have anything to add, but they really want to thank you because they say no one else in the media is saying what you are saying. So thank you so much, Imran Faraz, Tamim Ansari, and Rafia Zakaria. You can find more about their work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you all so much for joining us. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, Kevin Vance, our engineer, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.